This week on the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, what role does staging play in pressure injury care? Stick around. Hey out there, welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I'm an attorney and I will be your host for this episode. This week, we're talking about staging and pressure injuries with Dr. Aletha Tippett. We get into a fantastic conversation about her views on staging, how staging relates to communications with providers. And then we talk about an interesting story in her experience about essentially consulting and administering pressure ulcer interventions in a particular nursing home that resulted in phenomenal outcomes for the residents there. So stick around. We're gonna do some things first. So if you're really interested in jumping right into that, feel free to fast forward, as they used to say in the 80s. Now it's time for the Nursing Home Regulation Question of the Week. And we're talking about, again, 483.21, that being the section of the regulations dealing with care planning. But specifically, we're talking about the baseline care plan for this question. Under 42 USC 483.21A1I, a baseline care plan must be developed within how long after a resident is admitted to a nursing home? A, 7 days. B, 48 hours. Or C, 12 hours. How long does a nursing home have to develop a baseline care plan after a resident is admitted? The answer is B, 48 hours. That's right. So once a resident is admitted, the nursing home must do the appropriate assessment and prepare and execute a baseline care plan within 48 hours. And that baseline care plan is going to be the care plan for that resident until a comprehensive care plan is made. So 48 hours, if you got that right, I'm going to say this one was of not too hard of a difficulty. I think this was kind of easy. So I think this was a 10 point. So if you got, it's a 10 pointer. If you got this one right, give yourself 10 points, pat on the back. All right, now it's time for the Nursing Home ChatGPT joke of the week.
The ChatGPT generated nursing home regulation joke of the week.
Skynet.
So I heard the long-term care survey manual is now called the watermelon book. I mean, what's next? Are we using fruit names for all official documents? The grape guidelines for taxation? The banana bylaws of building codes? But hey, at least when you're done reading the watermelon book, you don't have to worry about swallowing the seeds. Just the bureaucracy.
I'm going to say that I think that one was a pretty good one. That's I have nothing bad to say about that joke. That was pretty good. Okay, all the jokes can't be winners. So let's get into the substance of the episode. So we're going to be talking with Dr. Aletha Tippett this week. Dr. Tippett has a BS in chemical engineering, and she got her medical degree from the University of Cincinnati. She's renowned for her expertise in family medicine, palliative and hospice care, and wound care. A retired family physician from Ohio, Dr. Tippett specializes in wound care, particularly in limb salvage and pressure ulcer prevention, treating over 15,000 wounds in her career. She is a celebrated author, international speaker, and recipient of numerous healthcare awards. We are so happy to have her on the podcast this week. And actually, we're going to link in the show notes a copy of a study an article that she wrote about her experience in consulting in a particular nursing home that led to exceptional outcomes for the residents there in terms of pressure injuries. But be sure to check that out, read that, check out her website. She's fantastic. If you have any questions for her, you can absolutely reach out to her via her email. And her email address is tippettaw@fuse.net. Definitely you can email her if you have any further questions or want to hear her story about that specific experience at that nursing home with the outrageous results. Lovely talking to her. She's awesome. We actually had her on a previous episode, which we'll talk about. So she's a veteran of the podcast. And with that, Dr. Tippett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, I kind of told the audience a little bit about you before you came on, and we were kind of talking before the show that you and I spoke together, but this has been almost, I guess, 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. It was July of 2020. We talked about pressure ulcers then, and now we're going to be talking about pressure injuries again today. So I'm happy that you can be here. Just to kind of kick it off, regular listeners, regular watchers of this program, or this, I don't even know what we call this, a podcast program episode. We talk about pressure injuries a lot because it's a major problem in the long-term care setting. But in terms of honing in on that particular topic, today we're talking about staging and what does it mean? So what in your understanding, in your research, in your knowledge, what do pressure ulcer stages mean? What is that when we say there's a stage of pressure injury?
Well, stage really is just at that point in time, how thick is your ulcer? That's all it's telling you.
I
So
see.
you could have stages 1 through 4. That's just different levels of thickness. Like a one is just your skin might be red or pink. If you're a white person, if you're a dark person, it's harder to tell what color that might be, but it might be lighter or darker. It's mushy, maybe. That's a one. A two means, like, if you just scrape the top of your skin off, that's a two. And a three means you've taken all the whole skin off and down here down to muscle. And four means you've gone all the way down to the bone.
So I guess that's probably why staging is important, because we're at different progressions of the actual injury, the wound itself. And I would imagine that each stage probably has its own treatments. Maybe you're doing things that you would do at stage one that you wouldn't do at stage four, and vice versa. So it kind of talk about that. Like, is that kind of an important reason why we make distinctions between stages, the treatment?
Well, your treatments are going to be different. You don't need to know the stage in order to treat a wound. I mean, if I'm looking at a wound and I see it, I can figure out what it needs without knowing what the stage is. You know, the stage maybe helps me communicate to other people, you know, what I'm working with. It's stage is more of a communication tool than actual. Doesn't really mean anything to the wound. I mean, it doesn't tell you how the wound got there. It doesn't tell you where the wound is going. Just tells you where it is right now when you're looking at it.
Right. So, but I guess that makes sense. So staging, at least in part, is important in terms of how you communicate that to the next shift or to the next provider.
Correct.
But I guess, would it be important to you to get the stage at least somewhat approximated correctly? Like, you wouldn't want to come to a resident or a patient where you've been told it's a stage four, but it's a stage one. So I guess that there would be some importance in how that's communicated.
Oh, sure. You'd be expecting something very different if that happened. You know, and of course, you'd have to alter what you were planning to do, you know, would change everything, you know. But the stage by itself is not important as a thing. You can't design a plan around staging because that don't work. You know, staging is just how thick that is at the time, and different things may affect that. You know, the actual person, maybe their skin doesn't break down. Maybe someone else's breaks down right away. You know, you just don't know.
Right. That makes sense. Like, so tell me then, like, what are some misconceptions that the public has about staging? Like, what are some things that you would see? You're like, you hear and you're kind of like, like, this is wrong. Like, tell me about that.
Well, the biggest thing that's come to understanding in, say, the last 15 years is deep tissue injury. Now, that is really important. Let me ask this. Do you know how long it takes to create an ulcer?
I mean, from my anecdotal experience, it can take as little as a few hours to develop an ulcer.
2 hours is all it takes
Yeah.
to get an ulcer. So, say you fell off your ladder and you were laying on the ground, and it took a while for someone to find you and call the 911 and all that. Maybe you were laying there for 8 hours. That's a lot of pressure on your backbone and on the butt bones that you're laying there. Now, you're not going to see anything right away. You say, oh, he looks all right. And he goes in and whatever they do. And about 2 weeks later, they say, gosh, it looks like a bruise developing on his butt. And but it's not open, it's just a dark discoloration. And then a couple days later, there's a wound there. And they're all going, how, where'd that come from? Where'd that come from? That came from him laying on the ground when he was first injured. And you don't see it for maybe 6 weeks even before it would happen. Now, the trouble is, and nursing homes or whoever's taking care of this guy get in trouble because the wound, no matter what they do, the wound keeps getting bigger and bigger. And everyone thinks, oh, they're not doing the right thing. They're doing wrong. They're not. The wound is going to the bottom of that injury. It goes all the way down to the bone. Then it'll start healing. So you're just wasting your time if you're thinking that you're not doing the right thing. If you're treating it, you're doing the best you can do, but you're not going to make it go away. It's going to, and not until the physiologic process happens where the wound goes to the bottom and then it'll start healing. But that's deep tissue injury. And I have had a lot of experience with that in legal cases because it's a big deal.
Sure, because it's, I guess, from what I understand you to say is that a deep tissue injury, as opposed to maybe a standard pressure injury, is that it almost starts from the bottom and goes to the top. So
Yes, that's exactly right.
it's not as easily observable as
It's not
a
observable at all. You don't see it for maybe weeks,
right. You would, but I guess if you suspected a deep tissue injury, there are ways to observe for it. Like, for example, you could do a skin test in terms of like look for blanchable skin, things like that. In your experience, is that something
That,
that's
I don't think
possible for
that would
everyone?
help you as much. The most important thing is to understand the history of what happened to this patient. And if you know about deep tissue injury, then you know that if he was laying there for hours, he's probably going to have some deep tissue injury. So you can watch for that. You can note it in your notes that probable deep tissue injury, and then people will be alert and watching for it.
Right. And of course, you would, if you suspect deep tissue injury, one of the primary interventions in that respect would be to offload that area.
Oh, absolutely. That's the trick always to prevent any pressure injury is to offload.
Right.
And if you have deep tissue injury, you better be offloading,
Okay. Okay. Well, that, I mean, I would agree with you. I think that the concept of deep tissue injury is not very well known in the public and in some instances in my field of the plaintiff's bar. But do you, in what other misconceptions do you see possibly with families of loved ones and that have somebody in a nursing home? Like, what are some misconceptions that they might have that maybe they need to be turned every 15 minutes or something like that? In your experience, are there any?
I don't know that I could answer that really. I mean, I don't know what kind of misconceptions families have for their loved ones in the nursing home. I mean, I've worked in a lot of nursing homes, but I guess I don't have that much interface with the families about what they're concerned about or what misconception they might have. Typically, the nurses should be talking to the families and telling them what's going on, and sometimes the families are there when they're taking care of wounds or doing something like that, and that helps too, help keep them up to speed. It's really interesting. I've worked with one nursing home in Delhi, and they had a horrible pressure injury rate, and the federal government was just about to close them down. They were had a G level citation or whatever it was. Anyway, and they were about to be closed down. They called me. I went out there and I helped them, and they went 6 years without an ulcer. Not one ulcer in 6 years. So I thought that was pretty dramatic change, you know? But they were very committed to getting rid of pressure ulcers.
Well, that's an extremely, I mean, that's a wonderful story. Like no pressure injuries in
6 years.
6 years. That's amazing. So what was implemented? Like, what are some things that in terms of pressure injury prevention that maybe
Well,
you put in place?
it's actually very simple. And you know, first when I proposed the program, I mean, we all worked together and we got the program started. And after about a month or two into the program, I'd be walking through the hall and I'd be stopped by different aides who would come up to me and say, "Gosh, this is so easy compared to what we used to do. Thank you so much." You know, so the people doing it found it very simple and very easy, and you know, would even tell me how easy it was, and they were really happy. But it's the pressure support. You know, you talk about offloading. The key is the proper pressure support. And we went with a product. It's a static air, inflated air. And we put it on every bed and every chair for every person. It didn't matter. We didn't stratify them at all. Everyone who's there is at risk. And we put an air mattress on their bed and put an air pad on their chair. And if their feet were in trouble, we got air boots for their feet. And we lubricated their skin every day. I think we used bag balm all over their skin every day. If you can't use bag balm, you can use A and D ointment, something like that. But we lubricated and we had pressure support and we had zero pressure injuries.
Well, I think that if I can throw this out there, like just the concept that everyone is at risk for pressure injury is probably revolutionary. I mean, like
It is. It is. Yes. We did not stratify at all. We didn't have to do a Braden scale. We didn't do anything. If you're here, you're at risk. End of story. And we're going to protect you. That was the attitude, and that worked. I mean, that's how we went to zero.
So, like, did you receive any pushback from staff, from administration in terms of like, whoa, like, I mean, this is gonna
No.
raise labor costs or whatever, anything
Nope.
like that?
Nope. They were 100% for it. I mean, we started with the whole group. I mean, it wasn't just me. They were all in the team, and I showed them everything, and we talked about it and debated it, and they picked to go with the static air. Now, the interesting is the thing, they had just gotten a massive citation and were about to be closed down. What they had on every bed before that was alternating pressure pads. Which I hate alternating pressure because they create more injury than they prevent. But they're promoted big time. And so they were sold a bill of goods. They put alternating pressure pads on all their beds. And guess what? They had a lot of ulcers from alternating pressure pads. They didn't know that. But when I went in and took pictures and looked at everybody, I said, "These beds are causing you a lot of problem."
And why
And we
is
see.
that? Is it because that you believe in your mind that because of the alternating pressure that you don't have to actually still physically turn or reposition them? Is that why? Or is there some other reason why they're not effective?
It's because the pads, you know, one will have pressure and one won't. The one that has pressure is causing injury. And you can, if you have someone that's on an alternating pressure pad and you look, take pictures, you can compare the pictures to where they're laying on the pad and see where it happened. You know, it's where the pressure is up on the pad.
I see.
And it was really interesting. But once the data was there, we looked at it, and the head of the nursing home said, "Get rid of all these and go with this." And she just said, "That's it." Of course, she knew that they were looming, the federal government was breathing down their neck, you know.
Sure. So
But
and I might have missed it, I apologize, but what are the support services that you use instead of the alternating the mattresses?
we use the static air.
Sedacare. Okay. So you've
We
got,
just,
yeah, I was going to say you've got everyone's a risk, everyone stays somewhat lubricated, at least the pressure points,
every day. No,
every
the
day,
whole body.
whole body.
And when we did that, we started hearing from old time nurses. We used to do that all the time. We lubed everyone up, and no one ever had a sore. And I
Right.
said, "That's old time coming back." We lubed everyone up, and I knew when I would take my rounds, if I could see that someone had dry skin, I knew that an ulcer was going to happen. So I'd tell them, "You better lube that skin, because it's going to be an ulcer if you don't."
So, this is amazing. So, you got, like you said, like the lubrication, everybody's a risk. The proper support service, jettisoning the support services that don't work. What else was applied to every single resident? Like, what are some other interventions that you made sure happened?
That's all we did. That's it. Pressure support and lubrication.
What do you think the concept of everybody's at risk? How does that translate to the overall philosophy or the overall like mindset of the staff? So, for example, like in your stand-up meetings in the morning, is that always a topic? Like, hey, listen, now we're at the part of the meeting. Tell me about so-and-so resident. Tell me about this wing and what we're doing today about lubricating everybody or whatever. Like, I guess the question is, does that translate that it's a constant? Everyone's constant job is to think about this in terms of preventing the ulcers every day.
It should be. Now, I wasn't at stand-up meetings because I only went once a week to the
Sure.
home and did training for everybody and stuff. And so in my training, we talked about that.
Right.
But, I assumed that they did that at their stand-up meetings. It really, when you get down to it, any person that goes into any facility, hospital, nursing home, assisted living, that you should assume that they are at risk. You do not need to stratify the risk. You could do a Braden scale, but so what? Might as well flip a coin. The Braden scale is right 50% of the time.
Interesting.
So how are you going to know that they're at risk if half the time it doesn't even tell you? It tells you that they're at no risk and they get an ulcer. So what I when I read that report on the Braden scale, I said, "What good is a Braden scale? It just everyone's at risk, and you do the whole thing for everybody,
I
and
see.
then you'll be all right."
I see. Well, that's a fantastic story. Have you approached this from an academic standpoint in terms of trying to draw something up and convince other administrations
No, I haven't done that. I published the article, and I presented it at symposiums. But I don't think it didn't turn people on.
Why do you think that is? Like, I mean, like,
I don't know. I really don't know, because I'm thinking, how can you ignore going to zero? How can you ignore it
for 6 years.
for 6 years? How can you ignore that? How can you just say, "Oh, well, you should have done this"? And I said, "I don't know. I don't know if it's the bed manufacturers that control it. I don't know, because the static air is cheap, 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 like $60 for a bed.
Right. Have you been able to repeat that success anywhere else?
I haven't had the opportunity,
I see.
but individually, sure. We can do it individually, but
Right.
I haven't worked with another facility.
At that level, yeah. Okay. Well, what do you in your speaking of that then, what inspired you to go to this direction with wound care and wound treatment? Like what put you down that path?
I guess my engineering background, I understood pressure injury, and and I looked at the mechanics. One of my heroes is Paul Brandt. He was a doctor that worked in Africa, but he always said, it's the mechanics. It's not anything else. It's all about mechanics. And I said, Dr. Brandt, you are so right. Because me as an engineer, I knew that it was all about the mechanics, you know? So a lot of times people, well, how is this wound that, like this? Why is it like this? And then I'll go in and look at the wound and I'll see the aide sitting there and I'll talk to the aide. And I say, this patient is up in her chair. Does she stay sitting up in her chair? And the aide will say, no, she slides down. I said, bingo, that's how the wound is where it is, you
Right,
know?
right.
But you have to hunt out, you have to look and you have to ask. You can't just assume anything.
That's interesting. You say it's the mechanics. Like I'm sure that like your mind is thinking of these things in such a different way, like more of an analytical, like I don't know, like scientific and physics and how is the body, sitting in this
Exactly,
spot.
exactly.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that interaction with that aide, what role does awareness of those type of things play in the prevention and management of pressure wounds? Like, how important is it for that CNA to know that you're going to get shear forces and friction when somebody slides, and maybe they need to not be sitting there for so long?
If you to take 2 minutes and explain it to them, they understand. People intuitively understand. You know, when you're talking about the physics of it, they get it. They really do. And families typically will understand better than nurses. You know, I mean, when I talk to them, they understand and they can figure out ways to do it, you know. But yeah, well, I wanted the aide to change her views. I would just spend a couple minutes and train her about it. That's all.
Right. Kind of like as we wrap up, I just kind of wanted to circle back on something that you said a little bit earlier, and that staging is a communication tool, and that it doesn't tell you where the wound is going. Can you tell me about that? What does that mean to you? What does that mean that staging doesn't tell you where the wound is going?
Well, staging is right now, at this point in time, as I'm looking at this wound, I can tell you what stage it is. And that's just the thickness of the wound. It's a 1, 2, 3, or 4, all right? So that's just the thickness of the wound. It doesn't tell me how it got there. It doesn't tell me where it's going. Now, if it's a 4, it doesn't have anywhere else to go, right? If it's a 1, I don't want it to go any further, so I better make sure I'm preventing pressure, doing offloading, doing all that, everything I can to prevent it, lubricating it with calmiseptin or whatever, you know. And if it's a 2, you can almost treat it like a 1, really. You could still use calmiseptin. But if it goes to a 3, then you're going to have to start using a dressing on it. But you know, you don't want it to progress. Your goal is, my goal is always 0, you know, and I think your goal should be 0. You don't want a wound. You don't want a wound. None of us want a wound on our body. I mean, it's a horrible thing. And, you know, I guess too, because I work in hospice, so I know that wounds are a terrible thing for people to live with. It's an awful burden. So if you can prevent them, that's really valuable. That's important and very valuable. But staging by itself doesn't help me prevent a wound. You know, tells me where it is, but doesn't help me prevent it.
Well, let me ask this. Are you like Is there anything in your mind, like some people I've seen propose the idea of only saying partial thickness or full thickness, meaning that it's still at the epidermis or it's actually gone to the muscle or tissues, and that's how we document pressure injuries. Like, have you given any thought to, well, let's get rid of the staging and
Yeah,
just document it another way?
the partial thickness of full thickness is reasonable. That's a stage two and a stage three, but that's all right. But yeah, partial and full, that's reasonable. People can understand that. So, if you're using it as communication, that's fine.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Tippett, I really appreciate it. Once again, I really enjoy talking to you about this stuff. It's been a while. Maybe we won't wait another 4 years to talk again. But I appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you very much. It was fun being here.
Again, folks, if you want to learn more about her experience at that specific nursing home with the tremendous outcomes, there's a link in the description to that article. Also, feel free to shoot her an email or visit her website. Really, really interesting story with her. Again, thank you so much. This is, again, I feel like we're every week we're trying to get a little bit better, trying to understand the world now. It's been a long time since we did our last podcast, at least a few years. So still trying to get the bugs out. So appreciate everybody's patience. Hope you learned something this week. And with that, folks, be sure to like and subscribe wherever you're listening or watching this episode. And with that, we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal or medical advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes, for now, are available every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.